Hello and welcome to the Growing Leaders podcast. Mary Steves here alongside our fearless leader, Dr. Tim Melmore. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. Tim, it's good to be podcasting today.
Yes, it is.
I'm looking forward to our conversation today, and we're excited to welcome to the conversation Dr. Brett Andriotta. Dr. Andriotta is an author, speaker, consultant, and coach. You might have even heard her TEDx talk entitled How Your Past Hijacks Your Future. I know I really enjoyed listening and seeing that TEDx. Tim, I'm going to pass it back to you so that you can ask Britt some in-depth questions and just tell us more about the topic that we get to talk about today.
Absolutely. We are very, very excited about this because I think that, first of all, lots and lots of brain research has been uncovered over the since the turn of the century. And Britt, you are one great voice that's just helping us understand what's happened and what we can understand about our minds and our brains. So thank you for joining us on this conversation.
Well, I'm excited to be with you today.
So let me start, Britt, with this. In your first book, Wired to Grow, you explore the brain science of learning. What led you to write that book?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm first and foremost an educator, so I'm always looking for ways to improve my own craft. I was a professor and dean at the University of California for 20 years, and then I segued into a role as the chief learning officer for Lynda.com, one of the premier providers of online training. So I started studying neuroscience to improve my own ability to design and deliver effective learning experiences for all ages. I mean, I was working a lot with college students and then professionals of all ages. Yeah. And what I learned really changed how I approached learning. And I realized that other people might be interested in harvesting what I had learned for myself. So I ended up turning it into a book so I could share it with other learning professionals.
How about that? That's neat. So what are some of the key takeaways that you would offer from that book?
Well, it was interesting because as I studied all the neuroscience, and I'm not a neuroscientist myself, but I have a doctorate in education, leadership, and organization. So I know my way around academic journals and how to really read studies. And what's really fascinating about neuroscientists is that they're all studying very minute sections of the brain or very, you know, very specific functions of the brain. So they're not really talking to each other across these disciplines or perspectives. So it was really fun to kind of synthesize all of that different amazing research. And what became clear to me was that learning actually occurs in three phases, and different parts of the brain play a role in each of these phases. So the first phase is when we actually sit down to learn something, and that's the hippocampus is the brain structure that takes what we're listening or watching and puts it into our short-term memory. And what's really interesting about the hippocampus is it needs to process content every 20 minutes or so to move it effectively into our memory. Hmm. And so that really shifted how I organize my learning events. The second phase is remember. So we've got to get it into that long-term memory so that we can get back to it, you know, weeks or months or even years from now. So thinking about how do we get it into long-term memory, there's actually very specific strategies we can use to do that. And the most effective, and this is what good teachers kind of learned how to do a long time ago, is when we attach it to something that the learner already knows or has experienced. Yeah. These are called schemas, and you're attaching it to a cluster of neural wiring that already exists in the learner's brain.
Yeah.
The other big aha was around retrievals. You know, back in the day when we were younger, it was all about repetition. Keep doing those math problems over and over. Keep writing it over and over. Well, what we're learning is that to get it into long-term memory, it's really pulling it back out, quizzing yourself, retrieving the information is kind of the sweet spot. And it turns out it's three retrievals spaced with sleep is where the magic happens.
Ah, say that again real quick.
It's three retrievals spaced with sleep. So if you learned something today, a way to really help yourself remember that, or if you're a teacher, is tomorrow or the day after is ask people to summarize it or take a quiz on it.
So
they have to reach back into their brain and pull it out. So three retrievals spaced with sleep is really the key element for getting stuff into long-term retention, long-term memory.
Interesting.
And then the third phase is do, which is about changing behaviors. And most of professional learning today, which is where I'm working these days, is about driving some specific behavior change. And so the research on how our brain forms a habit was what really informed me in this area. It turns out the brain structure is the basal ganglia, and it's what takes, when we repeat a behavior over and over, it's what makes it into a habit. And it takes about 40 to 50 repetitions of a new behavior before it really gets synced as a strong neural pathway or a habit.
Interesting. So I'm just looking at your book. The whole title is Wired to Grow, Harness the Power of Brain Science to Master Any Skill. So this is directed at anybody, not just college students, but anybody that you just want to learn to do something differently.
Absolutely. So, you know, the talks that I give, I talk to groups in two ways. I always tell people in the audience, like, you're a learner too. You're a lifelong learner. So use this for yourself. If there's anything you want to learn, mm-hmm. you can now be a real active participant mm-hmm. and driving your own learning more effectively. And if you're ever stuck with a not so great instructor, you can compensate by using these strategies to help yourself learn.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for us to empower people to own their own learning,
yes,
you know,
yes.
and be responsible for it.
Yeah.
And then certainly I speak to educators about how we can take this information and make our learning events more effective and more accessible to the learner.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's one of the many reasons we wanted you at our National Leadership Forum later this year. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So, Britt, I know you're an educator, mainly working on professional learning for adults. How did what you learned in this great book you've written shift your own approach?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And this is also true for working with children and young adults mm-hmm. as well. So there were three key things. There's probably more, but the three I could probably highlight for you is I now never talk for more than 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. In fact, my limit is 15 because I figure there's some variation in hippocampuses. So I will give some content for 15 minutes,
yeah.
and then I always have my learners go into some quick processing activity yeah. from anywhere from 1 to 5 minutes. It
yeah.
could be a dyad discussion, a quick free write, taking
yeah.
a little assessment. Hands-on activity, doesn't matter. All the tools teachers are already using are awesome. I just now make sure that I do them in 15-minute chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can string a bunch of those together to create a longer learning event, like a two-hour session or a half day. The other thing is I don't do full day trainings anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. when people hire me, they're like, can you do a full day?
Yeah,
and I'm like,
yeah.
let me do a half day the day before and then bring them back the next morning because I'll have slept and I can do a retrieval.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. That's
and
good.
We'll do the second half day because I know that the brain also needs time away from learning
mm-hmm. yeah.
to create room for insight. So mm-hmm. I also know I'm now much more mindful of people just are too full
yes.
by the time they get to the afternoon to really keep learning.
Well, and this is a little bit off track, but this is why I get so concerned just personally when I see K-12 schools reducing recess, taking away recess because we got to get these grades up, more class time. And I'm thinking they probably need recess just to do something different.
Yes, they do. Time away from learning is really important.
Yeah.
In fact, it's where a lot of the insight happens, where people mm-hmm. make those connections. And so I actually think about my learning events now to set them up for the break away from me.
Yes. Yeah.
So that I prime them for some of the insights I want them to have. A couple other things I did is because I now understand about schemas, I do a lot more thinking about who my audience is and how to attach what I'm talking about to something they already know.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that's easy to do, but oftentimes we don't really know what someone's life experience has
yeah,
been.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of things now like remember a time
yes,
or share
yeah.
a story of, because
yeah.
they'll bring up their own schemas
mm-hmm.
and I don't have to
yeah.
figure it out and have the perfect example.
Yeah, yeah. That's,
and
that's
then finally, cool. yeah, and finally the last big thing I do now, and I'm a big believer in this, particularly in corporate learning, is we have to build the behaviors in the room. So I actually think about what's the habit that I want
yeah.
someone to go back to their workspace and do.
Yeah.
And I have them do it in the training room with me so that we run a few of those neural pathways and start grooving that habit, get them started on their way to 40 to 50,
yeah.
As opposed to just talking about it
yeah.
and then hoping
yeah.
they'll do it.
Yeah, no, that's so true. I love that. You know, what excites me, there's several things I'm excited about what you're sharing. I just think it's so practical. But for years, I have so appreciated the idea of the schema, that framework with which we remember something because we attach it to something we already understand. we've developed a whole curriculum for leadership for students called Habitudes, and it's learning with images. So rivers and floods is a schema on focus. A flood is terribly unfocused, but a river is very focused. Well, even if they're not people that are in the river all the time, they understand that, and I think it helps them remember, you know, what they need to do with their lives. So it's just fun. Learning can be fun.
Yeah, fantastic, and a fantastic example of how you can leverage a schema.
Yeah. So most of our listeners are teachers, parents, coaches. What can you tell us about working with the ages, let's say, teenager and 16 to 24, and the adolescent brain? What can you help us with there?
Oh, well, that's a great question. There's so many people who are researching the adolescent brain.
Yeah.
That's not my area of expertise. I focused on the adult brain, but I can tell you the three phases are still true for every age group: the hippocampus, the basal ganglia, schemas. That's true for every age. So you can definitely continue to use those.
Yeah, good.
I have a 10-year-old. So the researchers I turn to keep me up on what's going on with child and adolescent brains are Carol Dweck's work on the growth mindset.
Yeah.
And really helping use language around not fixed traits, but practicing, improving, growing.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed the way I talk to my daughter immensely.
Yeah.
So I really love her stuff. There's a book called Nurture Shock by Bronson and Merriman, and they synthesized a lot of great research, particularly on like how important sleep is.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, a lot of school districts are pushing back the start time based on this research, because honestly, children's brains and the adolescent brain don't function that well at 8 a.m. They have a different sleep spot.
Yeah. Yes. Especially if they've gone to bed at 2 a.m.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the other two researchers I follow are Dan Siegel. He wrote The Whole Brain Child.
Yeah.
Again, lots of great brain research on child and adolescent brains. And then finally, Alan Kasdan from Yale. He runs the Yale Parenting Center. And he's using a lot of this research to help parents understand how you can leverage the way kids naturally learn and make it easier to parent, particularly around issues of boundaries and, you know, getting them to behave and how do you deal with discipline and all that kind of stuff. So Alan Kasdan's books on parenting, I think, are really fantastic, too.
Very helpful. And I concur. I loved Nurture Shock. I loved Mindset. These are just really practical but research-based books. Super.
Yes, absolutely.
Speaking of good books, I want to talk now about your newest book, Wired to Resist. So this is a little bit of a second cousin about how we're hardwired. But in your newest book, Wired to Resist, it's on the, as I understand it, it's on the neuroscience of change, and it's coming out this month, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's coming out by March 1st.
Okay, wonderful. That's exciting. Is there a connection between learning and change?
You know, it's funny because when I was researching the first book, Wired to Grow, I kept getting all these pieces on the brain and change. And so it was a natural kind of segue for me to move from one topic to the next. Because really, when you think about it, learning is all about change.
Yeah,
we're
really
taking
is.
People from one level of knowing or understanding to another. So we're trying to create change within their mental structures. And then separately, certainly in adult professional learning, it's often a change initiative that's being rolled out in the company that then is driving like this rush to training, like let's get a bunch of training in place to help people deal with change or make the change smoother. And it turns out a lot of that's not very effective. So I started researching that as a way to kind of go figure out what's going on with change, particularly why change doesn't succeed a lot in professional learning environments.
I remember somebody once said, maybe you know who said this, but years ago I heard somebody say, we only learn what we already know. And it was anecdotal, but it was kind of like the thing that you have to, when it comes to change, you often don't, you do resist at first. And almost time needs to pass, at least for me, before I'm convinced. That's so interesting that you would say, really, all learning means change. It's going to take some time, but you're going to eventually, if you've learned something new, you're going to have to change the way you think and perceive and eventually act. That's interesting.
Well, yeah. And you know, what's really fascinating is that neuroscientists with all the medical technology they have now can actually measure when learning happens in the brain. There's a permanent change in the brain. There's a permanent change in how the neurons fire. And so some neuroscientists are saying that should actually be the formal definition of learning, is that a permanent change in the brain occurred.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's huge.
I know.
Wow. So I want to kind of dig deeper here. You state in Wired to Resist that 50 to 70% of all change initiatives tend to fail. Why do you think that's, what do you think's behind all that?
Yeah, great question. So if you think about that, 50 to 70% of change initiatives, and that statistic has been long proven, that's billions of dollars.
Yeah.
I mean, billions
yeah.
of dollars probably, you know, every 6 months or so, if you think about globally what's
yeah.
happening.
Yeah.
And so when I was, you know, before I studied it, I wasn't sure what was going on with that. But now that I've studied the brain structures, I completely understand why.
Yeah, yeah.
As a species, we are wired to resist change. It's part of our survival mechanism. And our amygdala is actually set to detect change as threatening.
Hmm.
And so that's how we're predisposed, first of all. And those of us who are alive today are the descendants of people whose amygdala were very sensitive to change.
Hmm.
So we also have kind of an evolutionary thing going on here. But in addition, there's a couple other brain structures that drive our resistance to change. And one is the habenula, which is all about having us avoid repeating failure. So when we mess up at something, the habenula kicks in to make sure we don't do it again. The problem is a lot of change initiatives are poorly designed and not rolled out very well. And so they make change itself a big experience of failure. And so over time, more and more employees get more and more resistant to change. So there's a little bit of a cycle happening that plays out in work environments. And I actually go into detail. There's four key brain structures that play in our resistance to change. But once you understand them, you can lead change differently so that you're working with how the brain is and not fighting so hard against
yeah.
it.
That's good. That just makes sense. If I'm naturally going to resist, I need to make sure that I'm intentional about the change. Well, Britt, I mentioned this just briefly earlier. I am elated that you're going to be joining us at our National Leadership Forum in June of 2017. Our theme is fast forward, and we're talking about change. We're talking about, you know, how culture's changing, kids are changing. I would love for you to just comment on that real quick, because your book, Wired to Resist, you're going to talk a little bit about that and how it applies to us in our lives as we invest in the next generation.
Absolutely. And I'm so excited to join you guys. I can't wait to be there with you all. And so, you know, June seems like a long way away right now, but I know it's just around the corner.
That's
so
right.
It'll be great to connect.
Yeah.
I mean, the book that I wrote, I ended up, as I was writing it, realizing, gosh, this applies to all levels. I had originally started writing it for people who lead change. And then I was like, oh, my gosh, all of us have to go through
yes,
change.
Yeah.
Right now, as a country, we're going through change. And technology drives change every day. So it ended up being written kind of at three levels, like when you have change put upon you and you have to move through it, whatever that looks like. If you are in charge of making sure change happens and you're leading, you know, you're the one that has to implement
yeah.
a change that's been decided. And I can think of, you know, teachers and faculty all the time. They get, you know, word comes down from on high that
yeah.
this is changing, and then they're the one left having to move people through it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, people who design change, really understanding that the way they set up change can be, with a couple little shifts, can either make it much more likely to succeed or doom it to failure from the get-go. So within my book, I talk about kind of all of those levels, but it really comes down to a couple core things. One is that the brain needs to understand the why of the change.
Yeah.
For us to get on board with change and to get motivated to move through it, we have to understand the why, and we have to find a way to connect it to purpose, whether it's our, you know, the purpose of our job or the purpose of our organization, or maybe even personal purpose and meaning. That finding those connections is what helps people stay moving forward in the midst of the chaos that will
yeah.
come from the change.
Yeah.
All change creates some level of chaos.
Yeah, right.
So then the second part is just acknowledging that change is a disruptive event. It causes physical and emotional distress. So we do so much better if we plan for that, as opposed to pretending it's not there and hoping it'll go away.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, preparing people, helping people know, gosh, there's things you can do to move through change, and that's nurture yourself, dialing up self-care, working with others, creating a team experience so you don't feel alone. Yeah. And another thing I've become a huge proponent of is mindfulness, the mindfulness practices really help our brains become much more resilient and adaptive to change, and we get less flustered by it, and we recover quickly. The research on mindfulness is mind-blowing, pun intended.
No, it's true. In fact, just this last year, I really have begun some of the practices of mindfulness, just breathing and pausing and reflection, and I'm telling you, it is a difference maker. I feel more centered, and I feel like I'm able to take on new things that I might have felt attacked by prior to that.
Absolutely. And in fact, the research is so compelling on mindfulness. What was funny is I'm a pretty tightly wound person. Like, I'm the last person you think would ever meditate.
Yes, yes.
And as I was doing the research, I was like, oh, darn it, I have to meditate.
Yes,
like,
yes.
It's so compelling. I can't ignore this evidence.
Yeah.
So I started, I now meditate 10 minutes every day, and it changed my life. It just changed my life so much. But I actually try to weave it in a little mindfulness moment. I weave into learning events and stuff to help the audience also get more present and more calm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, the last thing that I kind of have woven into the book and we'll certainly talk about in June is, you know, what are some strategies you can use to lead better change? Because oftentimes when you are leading change, you got to get other people on board, and there's ways to do that effectively so that you can help everyone move forward in a positive way, as opposed to having a lot of chaos that's just constantly creating a rumble that is distracting.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm thinking as I'm listening to you about all the applications this has. This obviously has made you a better educator, but I bet it's made you a better mom. To your 10-year-old,
sure.
You're just more intentional, and you kind of know what your child is going through and so forth. So I want to real quick get very, very practical for our listeners. What are some strategies that we, everyday people, can use to help ourselves and others thrive through change? And we're probably all in the midst of some change right now, just because that's the name of our culture. So what would you say are some personal strategies we can use to help ourselves?
Well, there's one thing of assessment I take people through so that they can kind of understand all change is different, right? Some changes you want it. Like I chose to remodel my kitchen. Huge change, but I wanted it, right? So I have a motivation for that.
Exactly.
Even though it's going to be hard, it's something I'm moving toward, right?
You had the why. You had the why.
Yeah. And I'm personally connected to it, where a change that might come be put on me from an employee, as an employee, I might not want that change at all. So I'm going to have some natural resistance to it. So one thing is to kind of assess, am I leaning into this change? Am I digging in my heels and leaning away from it? That's going to tell you a lot about how much you need to compensate to get yourself to move through the second part of the assessment, which is how disruptive is this change?
How much
is it going to disrupt your life? How much work is it going to take? If you've got something that's high level of disruption and you're digging in your heels, that's very different than low level of disruption and you're running toward it, right? So I actually take people through this little quick assessment because it helps them realize, oh, okay, so if you've got a whole bunch of people that are resisting going through a pretty big change, the leadership skills and the strategies you're going to need to have that group go through smoothly are much more than if it's a small change that everyone's on board for.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So that can be something. And then, of course, I am always telling everyone, think of change like flu season. In fact, we were just talking about that before we started recording this call, right?
Yeah.
You know, when it's flu season, we know our body is likely to be exposed to stress. And so we sleep better. We wash our hands more. Mm-hmm. We might eat, more veggies and less sugar.
Yeah.
And yet when we go through change, we sometimes don't treat our body as if it's going through something stressful. Mm. So I think it's really important to think about how do I take care of myself in change? And then, of course, the equivalent of the flu shot, the antidote for all this stuff is mindfulness. So good. Starting a meditation Love practice it. Or yoga or something like yeah. that.
I mean, it sounds funny, but yes, change is like a disease. We've got a bug. It's a bug. But no, you're
yeah,
so
like
right.
Yeah, it's like a little virus. It's going to stress you out for a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, and we need to be ready for it. This is just wise advice, really wise. So again,
Thank
listeners,
you.
Just so you'll know, these two books, Wired to Grow and Wired to Resist, both just very, not only research-based, but very practical books on the brain and how to better leverage what you have inside. Britt, I have loved talking to you, but if you don't mind, I want to ask you one more question. As we've talked now, we've volleyed back and forth. I think this has been extremely helpful. Thanks for being helpful and practical. Is there anything else that you feel like you'd like to share, maybe that you didn't get to, and or maybe I didn't give a chance to, that would just be helpful on this theme?
You know, I would just say, I would just encourage all of us to keep looking to neuroscience and brain science as a way to guide what we're doing. So I encourage other people to kind of explore for themselves. A shameless plug, my book will be out in March, yeah. and you can learn more on my website, brittandriotta.com,
okay.
Or Amazon. And then I love connecting with fellow educators, so please connect with me on LinkedIn. I would love to connect with you and learn more about you.
There you go. So Dr. Britt Andriotta, Wired to Grow, Resist, Wired to Resist. Britt, I'm telling you, this sounds cheesy. I'm looking forward to meeting you and getting some time together in June where you're going to impart on a really great group of educators that really do want to change the world, starting with their students. Thank you for being with us today. I'm so grateful.
Dr. Andriotta, Tim, thanks so much for this conversation and for the insights shared and just how practical this conversation was. If you'd like to go deeper, we would love for you to join us at this year's National Leadership Forum in Atlanta. Dr. Andriotta will be joined by Dr. John C. Maxwell, Dr. Jean Twenge, all individuals who have been on our podcast before. But these 2 days is just chock full of dialogue and conversation that will really change the way that you teach, coach, parent, all of the above. To learn more, please visit our website at growingleaders.com, and we look forward to seeing you there. Tim, this conversation was just so helpful and so insightful. Talk to us a little bit more. I know we got some practical steps from Dr. Andriotta, but from your side, your view, tell us some more practical steps that we can take.
Sure. We always try to take just a couple of minutes at the end of these podcasts to make sure that the practicality is present, that we're relevant and helpful. In the dialogue that we have, I think a couple of things stood out to me, Mary, that mm-hmm. Britt shared. One was in her book, Wired to Grow, she talked about what she learned about the brain, that there's 3 iterations that you have to learn something and then have them pull it back up twice so they're remembering, and then sleep. So you don't download all the information at once. You don't have one big, long training day or try to download the entire section of a textbook and cram. That's why cramming before finals isn't always that helpful.
I should have learned that.
I know, but we tend to do it. Yeah. So that was one, making sure it's a process, not just a long, drawn-out event.
Yeah, and she was saying that she limits her speaking time to 15 minutes,
yeah,
15
yeah.
to 20, which I thought was...
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Well, and when I teach a habitude, that's what I try to do too. I yeah. smiled as she said it, because I thought we try to do a habitude, a little bit of data, a story, and then put them in small groups.
Mm-hmm.
Then another habitude, put them in small groups.
Mm-hmm.
So it really makes sense. It's almost like cutting up your steak, not eating the whole slab at once, but it's bites.
Yep.
So, and then also, I absolutely loved what she said about schemas.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an educator out there, you remember learning that word when you were going to college. Schemas are frameworks with which we remember things, because we always tie the new, not yet familiar topic to an already familiar topic. And as I mentioned, we tried to put together schemas with our habitudes.
Mm-hmm.
108 images, Mary,
mm-hmm.
that are all schemas for understanding discipline, focus, initiative, responsibility, all the fundamentals we think students need to learn as they become adults. So it's just fun to have somebody like her just confirm, yes, this is how we learn. That's how you remember. So your message is shareable, it's sticky, it's simple. And then her book, Wired to Resist, what a great... I think she's going to cover that in June when she's with us. What stood out to me is that this isn't just adults. Students are even wired to resist. Even though they're young and moldable, and you'd think they want to change every day, and in one sense they do, when they get new information that's not what they think they know, not what they assume to be true, they'll resist too. So you've got to give them the why. You've got to let them ramp up and get used to an idea. Just like if they were 55, you got to let that 15-year-old have the time necessary to be convinced before you go down the journey. So why before what? Lots of schemas and give it time. So really appreciated Britt today.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Tim. To all our listeners, thanks so much for joining us on the Growing Leaders Podcast, and we'll see you next time.